Sanctified cyanide, super quick arsenic, higgledy piggledy into the soup. Put out the mourning lamps, call for the coffin clamps, teach them to trifle with Flavia Deluce. My words came echoing back to me from the high painted ceiling of the foyer and the dark polished woodwork of the galleries above. Aside from the fact that it didn't mention poison hemlock, this little poem, which I had composed for an entirely different occasion, was otherwise a perfect expression of my present feelings. Across the black and white tiles I ran, and up the curving staircase to the east wing of the house. The Tar Wing, as we called it, was named for Tarquin Deluce, one of Harriet's ancient uncles who had inhabited Buckshaw before us. Uncle Tar had spent the greater part of his life locked away in a magnificent Victorian chemistry laboratory at the southeast corner of the house, investigating the crumbs of the universe, as he had written in one of his many letters to Sir James Jeans, author of The Dynamical Theory of Gases. Directly below the laboratory, in the long gallery, there is a portrait in oils of Uncle Tar. In it, he is looking up from his microscope, his lips pressed together and his brow furrowed, as if someone with an easel, a palette, and a box of paints had rudely barged in just as he was about to discover delusium. "Fizz off," his expression clearly says. "Fizz off and leave me alone." And so they had fizzed off. And so, eventually, had Uncle Tar. The laboratory and all that was in it was now mine and had been for a number of years. No one ever came here, which was just as well. As I reached into my pocket and pulled out the key, something white fluttered to the floor. It was the handkerchief I had lent Nia in the churchyard, and it was still vaguely damp to the touch. An image rose up in my mind of Nia as she had been when I first saw her, lying face down upon a weathered tombstone, hair spread out like a sea of red, her hot tears sizzling in the dust. Everything dropped into place like the tumblers in a lock. Of course! Vengeance would have to wait. With a pair of cuticle scissors I had pinched from Feely's vanity table, I snipped four damp discs from the linen handkerchief, taking care to avoid the green grass stains I had inflicted upon it, and cutting out only those parts diagonally opposite the stains, the spots into which Nia had wept. These I stuffed, with tweezers, into a test tube, which I then injected with a 3% solution of sulfosalicylic acid to precipitate the protein. This was the so-called Ehrlich test. As I worked, I thought with pleasure of how profoundly the great Alexander Fleming had changed the world when he accidentally sneezed into a petri dish. This was the sort of science that was dear to my heart. Who, after all, can honestly say they have never sneezed on a culture? It could happen to anyone. It's happened to me. After the sneeze, the magnificently observant Fleming noticed that the bacteria in the dish were shrinking back, as if in fear from the flecks of his spattered mucus. It wasn't long before he had isolated a particular protein in his snot that repelled bacteria in much the same way that the presence of a dog foaming at the mouth keeps off burglars. He called it lysozyme, and it was this substance for which I was now testing. Fortunately, even in high summer, the ancestral halls of Buckshaw were as cold and dank as the proverbial tomb. Room temperature in the east wing, where my laboratory was located, in spite of the heating that had been spitefully installed by warring brothers in only the west wing of the once politically divided house, was never more than 60 degrees Fahrenheit, which, as luck would have it, was precisely the temperature at which lysozyme precipitates when sulfosalicylic acid is added. I watched entranced as a veil of crystals began to form, their white flakes drifting gently down in the little winter inside the test tube. Next, I lit a Bunsen burner and carefully warmed a beaker of water to 70 degrees. It did not take long. When the thermometer indicated that it was ready, I dipped the bottom of the test tube into the warm bath and swirled it gently. As the newly formed precipitate dissolved, I let out a gasp of delight. Flavia! Father's faint voice came drifting up to the laboratory. Having traversed the front hall, floated up the curving stair, penetrated the east wing, and wended its way down the long corridor to its southernmost point, it now seeped through my closed door, its force spent, as wispy as if it had come drifting to England all the way from Ultima Thule. Supper, I thought I heard him call. It's damnably irritating, Father said. We were seated round the long refectory table, Father at the far end, Daffy and Feely one on each side, and me at the very bottom, at Cape Horn. It's damnably irritating, he said again. For one to sit here and listen to one's daughter admit that she absconded with one's eau de cologne for a bloody chemical experiment. No matter if I denied these things or admitted my guilt, Father found it equally irritating. I simply couldn't win. I had learned that it was best to remain silent. Damn it, Flavia, I just bought the bloody stuff. Can't very well go up to London in this heat smelling like a shoulder of pork that's gone off, can I? Father was most eloquent when he was angry. I had nicked the bottle of Roger and Gallet to fill an atomizer with which I needed to spray the house after an experiment involving hydrogen sulfide had gone spectacularly wrong. I shook my head. I'm sorry, I said, assuming a hangdog look and dabbing at my eye with a napkin. I'd buy you a new bottle, but I have no money. As if I were a tin duck in a shooting gallery, Feely glared down the long table at me in silent contempt. Daffy's nose was stuck firmly in Virginia Woolf. But I could make you some, I said brightly. It's really not much more than ethanol, citrus oils, and garden herbs. I'll ask Dogger to pick me some rosemary and lavender, and I'll get some oranges and lemons and limes from Mrs. Mullet. You'll do no such thing, Miss Flavia, said Mrs. Mullet, bustling, literally, into the room as she knocked open the door with one of her ample hips and dumped a large tray onto the table. Oh, no, I heard Daffy whisper to Feely. It's the Whiffler again. The Whiffler, as we called it, was a dessert of Mrs. Mullet's own devising, which, so far as we could make out, consisted of a sort of clotted green jelly in sausage casings, topped with double Devon cream and garnished with sprigs of mint and other assorted vegetable refuse. It sat there, quivering obscenely now and then, like some great beastly garden slug. I couldn't help shivering. Yummy, Father said. How very yummy. He meant it ironically, but Mrs. Mullet's antennae were not attuned to sarcasm. I knew you'd like it, she said. It was no more than this morning I was saying to my elf, it's been a while since the Colonel and those girls have had one of my lovely gels. They always remarks over my gels. This was no more than the truth, and I loves making them for the dears. She made it sound as if her employers had antlers. Feely made a noise like a distressed passenger at the rail of the Queen Mary on a November crossing of the North Atlantic. Eat it up, dear, said Mrs. Mullet, unfazed. It's good for you. And with that, she was gone. Father fixed me with that gaze of his. Although he had brought the latest issue of the London Philatelist to the table, as he always did, he had not so much as opened it. Father was a keen, not to say rabid, collector of postage stamps, his life wholly given over to gazing through a magnifying lens at a seemingly endless supply of little coloured heads and scenic views. But he was not looking at stamps now. He was looking at me. Well, the omens did not bode well.
Where were you all afternoon? He asked.
At church, I answered promptly and primly and, I hoped, a little devoutly. I was a master at this kind of deflected chit-chat.
Church? He asked.
He seemed rather surprised.
Why?
I was helping a woman, I said. Her van broke down.
Ah, he said, allowing himself a half-millimeter smile. and there you were on the spot to offer your skills as a motor mechanic.
Daffy grinned at her book, and I knew that she was listening with pleasure to my humiliation. To give her credit, Feely remained totally absorbed in polishing her fingernails on her white silk blouse. "She's with a travelling puppet show," I said. "The vicar asked them, Rupert Pawson, I mean, and Nia, that's her name, to put on a performance in the parish hall on Saturday, and he wants me to help." Father deflated slightly. The vicar was one of his few friends in Bishop's Lacey, and it was unlikely he would deny my services. "Rupert is on the television," I volunteered. "He's quite famous, actually."
"Not in my circles," Father said, looking at his wristwatch and pushing his chair back from the table. 8 o'clock, he said, Thursday.
He did not have to explain himself. Without a word, Daffy and Feely and I got up and made dutifully for the drawing room, all in a scattered line like a convoy. Thursday evenings were wireless night at Buckshaw. Father had recently decreed that we needed to spend more time together as a family, and so it was that wireless night had been laid on as a supplement to his regular compulsory lecture series on Wednesdays. This week it was to be the fabulous Fifth Symphony by Ludwig von Beethoven, or Larry as I called him whenever I wanted to aggravate Feely. I remembered that Feely had once told us that, on the original printed score, Beethoven's given name had appeared as Louis. Louis Beethoven sounded to me like the name of one of the supporting gangsters in an Edward G. Robinson film, someone with a sallow, pockmarked face, an alarming twitch, and a Thompson submachine gun in a violin case. "Play that Moonlight Sonata thing by Louis B.," I'd snarl in my raspy mobster's voice, wandering into the room when she was practicing at the keyboard. A moment later, I'd be in full flight, with Feely in hot pursuit and sheet music floating to the carpet. Now, Feely was busily arranging herself in an artistic full-length pose on the Chesterfield, like a film star. Daffy dropped down sideways into an overstuffed armchair, with her legs hanging out over the side. Father switched on the wireless and sat down in a plain wooden chair, his back ramrod straight. As the valves were warming up, I did a handspring across the carpet, walked back across the room on my hands, and dropped into a cross-legged Buddha position with what I hoped was an inscrutable look on my face. Father shot me a withering look, but with the program already beginning, he decided to say nothing. After a long and boring spoken introduction by an announcer, which seemed likely to run on into the next century, the Fifth Symphony began at last.
Da-da-da-da!
I cupped my chin in my hands, propped my elbows on my knees, and gave myself over to the music. Father had told us that the appreciation of music was of paramount importance in the education of a decent woman. Those were his exact words, and I had come to appreciate that there was music suitable for meditation, music for writing, and music for relaxation. With my eyes half closed, I turned my face towards the windows. From my vantage point on the floor, I could see both ends of the terrace reflected in the glass of the French doors, which stood ajar, and unless my eyes were playing me tricks, something had moved out there. Some dark form had passed by outside the window. I didn't dare leap up to look, though. Father insisted on intent listening. Even so much as a tapping toe would meet instantly with a wicked glare and an accusatory downward jabbing finger. I leaned slightly forward and saw that a man dressed all in black had just sat down on a bench beneath the rose bushes. He was leaning back, eyes closed, listening to the music as it came floating out through the open doors. It was Dogger. Dogger was Father's man with a capital M. Gardener, chauffeur, valet, estate manager, and odd job man. As I have said before, he had done it all. Dogger's experiences as a prisoner of war had left something broken inside him. Something that from time to time, with a ferocity beyond belief, went ripping and tearing at his brains like some ravenous beast, leaving him a trembling wreck. But tonight he was at peace. Tonight He had dressed for the symphony in a dark suit and what might have been a regimental tie, and his shoes had been polished until they shone like mirrors. He sat motionless on the bench beneath the roses, his eyes closed, his face upturned like one of the contented Coptic saints I had seen in the art pages of Country Life. His shock of white hair lit from behind by an unearthly beam from the setting sun. It was pleasant to know that he was there. I stretched contentedly and turned my attention back to Beethoven and his mighty fifth. Although he was a very great musician and a wizard composer of symphonies, Beethoven was quite often a dismal failure when it came to ending them. The fifth was a perfect case in point. I remembered that the end of the thing, the Allegro, was one of those times when Beethoven just couldn't seem to find the off switch. Dum, 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 it would go, and you would think it was over. But no! Dum, da, dum, da, dum, da, dum, da, dum, da, dum, da, dum. You'd go to get up and stretch, sighing with satisfaction at the great work you just listened to, and suddenly, da, dum, da-dum, da-dum, and so forth. Da-dum. It was like a bit of flypaper stuck to your finger that you couldn't shake off. The bloody thing clung to life like a limpet. I remembered that Beethoven's symphonies had sometimes been given names. The Eroica, the Pastorale, and so forth. They should have called this one the Vampire, because it simply refused to lie down and die. But aside from its sticky ending, I loved the fifth, and what I loved most about it was the fact that it was what I thought of as running music. I pictured myself, arms outspread, running pell-mell in the warm sunshine down Guja Hill, swooping in broad zigzags, my pigtails flying behind me in the wind, bellowing the fifth at the top of my lungs. My pleasant reverie was interrupted by Father's voice.
"This is the second movement now, Andante con moto,"
he was saying loudly. Father always called out the names of the movements in a voice that was better suited to the drill hall than to the drawing room.
"Means at a walking pace, with motion," he added,
settling back in his chair as if, for the time being, he'd done his duty. It seemed redundant to me. How could you have a walking pace without motion? It defied the laws of physics. But then, composers are not like the rest of us. Most of them, for instance, are dead. As I thought of being dead and of churchyards, I thought of Nia. Nia! I had almost forgotten about Nia. Father's summons to supper had come just as I was completing my chemical test. I formed in my mind an image of the slight cloudiness, the swirling flakes in the test tube, and the thrilling message they bore. Unless I was badly mistaken, Mother Goose was pregnant. Chapter 5. I wondered if she knew it. Even before she had risen up weeping from her limestone slab, I had noticed that Nia was not wearing a wedding ring. Not that that meant anything. Even Oliver Twist had an unwed mother. But then there had been the fresh mud on her dress. Although I had registered the fact in some tangled thicket of my mind, I had given it no further thought until now. When you stopped to think about it, though, it seemed perfectly obvious that she had piddled in the churchyard. Since it hadn't rained, the fresh mud on her hem would indicate that she had done so, and hastily, at the northwest corner, away from prying eyes, behind the mound of extra soil that the sexton, Mr. Haskins, kept handy for grave-digging operations. She must have been desperate, I decided. Yes, that was it. There wasn't a woman on earth who would choose such an unwelcoming spot, wretchedly insalubrious, Daffy would have called it, unless she had no other choice. The reasons were numerous, but the one that leapt immediately to mind was one I had recently come across in the pages of the Australian Women's Weekly while cooling my heels in the outer chamber of a dentist's surgery in Farringdon Street. 10 early signs of a blessed event, the article had been called, and the need for frequent urination had been near the top of the list.
Fourth movement, Allegro, key of C major, father boomed, as if he were a railway conductor calling out the next station. I gave him a brisk nod to show I was paying attention, then dived back into my thoughts. Now then, where was I? Oh yes, Oliver Twist. Once, on a trip to London, Daffy had pointed out to us from the window of our taxicab the precise spot in Bloomsbury where Oliver's Foundling Hospital had stood. Although it was now a rather pleasant and leafy square, I had no trouble imagining myself plodding up those long-gone but nevertheless snow-drifted front steps, raising the huge brass door knocker and applying for refuge. When I told them of my semi-orphan life at Buckshaw with Feely and Daffy, there would be no questions asked. I would be welcomed with open arms. London! Damn and blast! I'd completely forgotten. Today was the day I was supposed to have gone up to the city with Father to be fitted for braces. No wonder he was peeved. While I was relishing death in the churchyard and chewing the fat with Nia and the vicar, Father had almost certainly been steaming and fuming round the house like an overstoked destroyer. I had the feeling I hadn't heard the last of it. Well, too late now. Beethoven was, at last, winding his weary way homeward, like Thomas Gray's ploughman, leaving the world to darkness and to me, and to Father. Flavia, a word, if you please, he said, switching off the wireless with an ominous click. Feely and Daffy got up from their respective places and went out of the room in silence, pausing only long enough at the door to shoot me a pair of their patented, now you're in for it, grimaces. Damn it all, Flavia, Father said when they had gone. You knew as well as I that we had an appointment for your teeth this afternoon. For my teeth? He made it sound as if the National Health were issuing me a full set of plaster dentures. But what he said was true enough. I had recently destroyed a perfectly good set of wire braces by straightening them to pick a lock. Father had grumbled, of course, but had made another appointment to have me netted and dragged back up to London, to that third-floor ironmonger's shop in Farringdon Street, where I would be strapped to a board like Boris Karloff as various bits of ironmongery were shoved into my mouth, screwed in, and bolted to my gums. I forgot, I said. I'm sorry. You should have reminded me at breakfast. Father blinked. He had not expected such a vigorous or such a neatly deflected response. Although he had been a career army officer, when it came to household manoeuvres, he was little more than a babe in arms. Perhaps we could go tomorrow, I added brightly. Although it may not seem so at first glance, this was a masterstroke. Father despised the telephone with a passion beyond all belief. He viewed the thing, the instrument, as he called it, not just as a letting down of the side by the post office, but as an outright attack on the traditions of the Royal Mail in general, and the use of postage stamps in particular. Accordingly, he refused, point blank, to use it in any but the direst of circumstances. I knew that it would take him weeks, if not months, to pick the thing up again. Even if he wrote to the dentist, it would take time for the necessary back and forth to be completed. In the meantime, I was off the hook. And remember, Father said, almost as an afterthought, that your Aunt Felicity is arriving tomorrow. My heart sank like Professor Picard's bathyscaph. Father's sister descended upon us every summer from her home in Hampstead. Although she had no children of her own, perhaps because she had never married, she had, nevertheless, quite startling views upon the proper upbringing of children, views that she never tired of stating in a loud voice. "Children ought to be horsewhipped," she used to say, "unless they are going in for politics or the bar, in which case they ought, in addition, to be drowned." Which quite nicely summed up her entire philosophy. Still, like all harsh and bullying tyrants, she had a few drops of sentimentality secreted somewhere inside that would come bubbling to the surface now and then, most often at Christmas, but sometimes belatedly for birthdays, when she would inflict her hand-picked gifts upon us. Daffy, for instance, who would be devouring Melmoth the Wanderer,
or Nightmare Abbey would receive from Aunt Felicity a copy of the Girls' Jumbo book, and Feely, who never gave a thought to anything much beyond cosmetics and her own pimply hide, would rip open her parcel to find a pair of gutta-percha motoring galoshes, ideal for country breakdowns. And yet once, when we had poked fun at Aunt Felicity in front of Father, he had become instantly as angry as I had ever seen him. But he quickly gained control of himself, touching a finger to the corner of his eye to stop a twitching nerve. "Has it ever occurred to you," he asked, in that horrible level voice, "that your Aunt Felicity is not what she may seem?"
"Do you mean to say," Feely shot back, "that this whole batty business is a pose?"
"I could only look on agog at her boldness." Father fixed her for a moment in the fierce glare of that cold blue Deleuze eye, then turned on his heel and strode from the room.
"Lawks a mercy," Daffy had said, but only after he had gone.
And so Aunt Felicity's ghastly gifts had continued to be received in silence, at least in my presence. Before I could even begin to recall her trespasses on my own good nature, Father went on.
"Her train gets into Doddingsley at 10:05, and I'd like you to be there to meet her.
But please don't argue, Flavia.
I've made plans to settle up a few accounts in the village. Ophelia is giving some sort of recital for the Women's Institute's morning tea, and Daphne simply refuses to go."
"Boil me dry. I should have known that something like this would happen."
"I'll have Mundy send round a car. I'll book him when he comes tonight for Mrs. Mullet."
Clarence Mundy was the owner of Bishop Lacey's only taxicab. Mrs. Mullet was staying late to finish off the semi-annual scouring of the pots and pans, a ritual that always filled the kitchen with greasy, superheated steam and Buckshaw's inhabitants with nausea. On these occasions, Father always insisted on sending her home afterwards by taxicab. There were various theories in circulation at Buckshaw about his reasons for doing so. It was obvious that I couldn't be en route to or from Doddingsley with Aunt Felicity and, at the same time, be helping Rupert and Nia set up their puppet show. I would simply have to sort out my priorities and attend to the most important matters first. Although there was a sliver of gold in the eastern sky, the sun was not yet up as I barreled along the road to Bishop's Lacey. Gladys's tyres were humming that busy, waspish sound they make when she's especially content. Low fog floated in the fields on either side of the ditches, and I pretended that I was the ghost of Cathy Earnshaw flying to Heathcliff, except for the bicycle, across the Yorkshire moors. Now and then, a skeletal hand would reach out of the bramble hedges to snatch at my red woolen sweater, but Gladys and I were too fast for them. As I pulled up alongside St. Tancred's, I could see Rupert's small white tent set up in the long grass at the back of the built-up churchyard. He had pitched it in the potter's field, the plots where paupers had been laid to rest and where, consequently, there were bodies but no tombstones. I suppose that Rupert and Nia had not been told of this, and I decided that they would not hear it from me. Before I had waded more than a few feet through the sodden grass, my shoes and socks were soaking wet.
"Hello," I called quietly. "Anyone home?"
There was no reply. Not a sound. I started as one of the curious jackdaws slipped down from the top of the tower and landed with a perfect aerodynamic plop on the crumbling limestone wall.
"Hello," I called again. "Knock, knock. Anyone home?"
There was a rustling in the tent and Rupert stuck his head out, his haystack hair falling over his eyes, which were as red as if they were driven by electric dynamos.
"Christ, Flavia," he said. "Is that you?"
"Sorry," I said. "I'm a bit early." He withdrew his head into the tent like a turtle, and I heard him trying to rouse Nia. After a few yawns and grumbles, the canvas began poking out at sudden odd angles, as if someone inside with a bees and broom was sweeping up broken glass. A few minutes later, Nia came half-crawling out of the tent. She was wearing the same dress as yesterday, and although the material looked uncomfortably damp, she had pulled out a woodbine and lighted it even before she had fully straightened up. "Cheers," she said, flapping an inclusive hand towards me and causing her smoke to drift off and mingle with the fog that hung among the gravestones. She coughed with a sudden horrid spasm, and the jackdaw, cocking its head, took several steps sideways on the wall, as if in disgust. "You oughtn't to be smoking those things," I said.
"Better than smoking kippers," she replied, and laughed at her own joke. "Besides, what do you know?"
I knew that my late-great-uncle, Tarquin de Luce, whose chemical laboratory I had inherited, had, in his student days, been hooted down and ejected bodily from the Oxford Union when he took the affirmative in a debate, resolved that tobacco is a pernicious weed. I had, not long before, come across Uncle Tar's notes tucked into a diary. His meticulous chemical researches seemed to have confirmed the link between smoking and what was then called general paralysis. Since he had been, by nature, a rather shy and retiring sort, his utter and abject humiliation, as he put it, at the hands of his fellow students, had contributed greatly to his subsequent reclusive life. I wrapped my arms around myself and took a step back. "Nothing," I said. I had said too much. It was cold and clammy in the churchyard, and I had a sudden vision of the warm bed I'd climbed out of to come here and help. Nia blew a couple of what were supposed to be casual smoke rings straight up into the air. She watched them ascend until they had dissipated. "I'm sorry," she said. "I'm not at my best at the crack of dawn. I didn't mean to be rude." "It's all right," I said.
But it wasn't.
A twig cracked, surprisingly loud in the muffling silence of the fog. The jackdaw unfolded its wings and flapped off to the top of a yew tree.
"Who's there?"
Nia called, making a sudden dash to the limestone wall and leaning over it.
"Bloody kids," she said, "trying to scare us. I heard one of them laughing."
Although I have inherited Harriet's extremely acute hearing, I had heard no more than the cracking of the twig. I did not tell Nia that it would be strange indeed to find any of Bishop Lacey's children in the churchyard at such an early hour.
"I'll set Rupert on them," she said. "That'll teach them a lesson. Rupert," she called out loudly, "what are you doing in there?" "I bet the lazy sods crawled back into the sack," she added with a wink.
She reached out and gave one of the guy ropes a twang, and like a parachute spilling the wind, the whole thing collapsed in a mass of slowly subsiding canvas. The tent had been pitched in the loose topsoil of the potter's field, and it crumpled at a touch. Rupert was out of the wreckage in a flash. He seized Nia by the wrist and twisted it up behind her back. Her cigarette fell to the grass.
"Don't ever," he shouted. "Don't ever!"
Nia motioned with her eyes towards me, and Rupert let go of her at once.
"Damn it," he said. "I was shaving. I might have cut my bloody throat."
He stuck out his chin and gave it a sideways hitch, as if he were freeing an invisible collar.
"Odd," I thought.
"He still has all his morning whiskers, and moreover, there's not a trace of shaving cream on his face."
"The die is cast," said the vicar. He had come humming across the churchyard like a spinning top, showing black and then white through the fog, rubbing his hands together and exclaiming as he came. "Cynthia has agreed to run up some handbills in the vestry, and will have them distributed before lunch. Now then, about breakfast." "We've eaten, thanks," Rupert said, jerking a thumb back towards the tent, which now lay neatly folded in the grass. And it was true. A few wisps of smoke were still drifting up from their doused fire. Rupert had fetched a box of wood chips from the back of the van, and in surprisingly short order had an admirable campfire crackling away in the churchyard. Next, he had produced a coffee pot, a loaf of bread, and a couple of sharpened sticks to make toast of it. Nia had even managed to find a pot of Scotch marmalade somewhere in their baggage.
"Are you quite sure?" the vicar asked. "Cynthia said to tell you that if..."
"Quite sure," Rupert said. "We're quite used to..."
"Making do," Nia said. "Yes, well then,"
the vicar said.
Shall we go in?
He shepherded us across the grass towards Parish Hall, and as he extracted a ring of keys, I turned to look back across the churchyard towards the lych gate. If someone had been there, they had since run off. A misty graveyard offers an infinite number of places to hide. Someone could well be crouching behind a tombstone, not 10 feet away, and you'd never know it. With one last apprehensive look at the remnants of the drifting fog, I turned and went inside.
Well, Flavia, what do you think?
My breath was taken away. What yesterday had been a bare stage was now an exquisite little puppet theatre, and such a one as might have been transported overnight by magic from 18th-century Salzburg. The proscenium opening, which I guessed to be 5 or 6 feet wide, was covered with a set of red velvet draperies, richly trimmed and tasselled with gold, and embroidered with the masks of comedy and tragedy. Rupert vanished backstage, and as I watched in awe, a row of footlights, red and green and amber, faded up little by little until the lower half of the curtains was a rich rainbow of velvet. Beside me, the vicar sucked in his breath as they slowly opened. He clasped his hands in rapture. "The Magic Kingdom," he breathed. There, before our eyes, nestled among green hills, was a quaint country cottage, its thatched roof and half-timbered front complete in every detail, from the wooden bench beneath the window right down to the tiny tissue paper roses in the front garden. For a moment, I wished I lived there, that I could shrink myself and crawl into that perfect little world in which every object seemed to glow as if lit from within. Once settled in the cottage, I would set up a chemical laboratory behind the tiny mullioned windows and... The spell was broken by the sound of something falling and a harsh damn from somewhere up in the blue-painted sky.
"Nia!"
Rupert's voice said from behind the curtains.
"Where's that hook for the thingamabob?"
"Sorry, Rupert," she called out, and I noticed that she took her time replying. "It must still be in the van. You were going to have it welded, remember?"
"It's the thing that holds the giant up," she explained.
"But then," she added, grinning at me, "we mustn't give away too many secrets. Takes all the mystery out of things, don't you think?" Before I could answer, the door at the back of the parish hall opened, and a woman stood silhouetted against the sunlight. It was Cynthia, the vicar's wife. She made no move to come in, but stood waiting for the vicar to come scurrying to her, which he promptly did. As she awaited his approach, she turned her face away to the outside light, and even from where I stood, I could clearly make out her cold blue eyes. Her mouth was as pursed as if the lips were pulled tightly shut with drawstrings, and her sparse grey-blonde hair was pulled, painfully it appeared, into an oval bun at the nape of an exceptionally long neck. In her beige taffeta blouse, mahogany-coloured skirt, and brown oxfords, she looked like nothing so much as an overwound grandfather clock. Aside from the sound thrashing she had given me, it was hard to put a finger on what, precisely, I disliked about Cynthia Richardson. By all reports, she was a saint, a tiger, a beacon of hope to the sick, and a comfort to the bereaved. Her good works were legendary in Bishop's Lacey. And yet, there was something about her posture that just didn't ring true. A horrid slackness, a kind of limp and tired defeat that might be seen in the faces and bodies of Blitz victims in the wartime issues of the Picture Post.
But in a vicar's wife?
All of this ran through my mind as she carried on a whispered consultation with her husband, and then, with no more than a lightning glance inside, she was gone.
"Excellent," the vicar said, breaking into a smile as he walked slowly towards us. "The Inglebys, it seems, have returned my call."
The Inglebys, Gordon and Grace, owned Culverhouse Farm,
a patchwork quilt of mixed fields and ancient woods that lay to the north and west of St. Tancred's.
Gordon's kindly offered you a place to pitch your tent at the bottom of Jubilee Field, a lovely spot. It's on the riverbank, not far from here. Walking distance, really. You'll have plenty of fresh eggs, the shade of incomparable willows, and the company of kingfishers.
Sounds perfect, Nia said. A little bit of heaven.
Cynthia tells me that Mrs. Archer rang up, too. Not such cheerful news on that front, I'm afraid. Bert's away to Cowley on a course at the Morris factory and won't be home until tomorrow night. Is your van in any sort of running order?
I knew by the worried look on the vicar's face that he was having visions of a van marked Pawson's Puppets parked at the door of the church come Sunday morning.
A mile or so shouldn't be a problem, Rupert said, appearing suddenly at the side of the stage. She'll run better now she's unloaded, and I can always baby the choke.
A shadow flitted across my mind, but I let it pass.
Splendid, said the vicar. Flavia, dear, I wonder if you'd mind going along for the ride. You can show them the way.
Chapter 6. Of course we had to go the long way round. Had we gone on foot, it would have been no more than a shady stroll across the stepping stones behind the church, along the river bank by way of the old towpath that marked the southern boundary of Malplaquet Farm and over the stile into Jubilee Field. But by road, because there was no bridge nearby, Culverhouse Farm could be reached only by driving west towards Hindley, then a mile west of Bishop's Lacey, turning off and winding tortuously up the steep west side of Gibbet Hill on a road whose dust was now rising up behind us in white billows. We were halfway to the top, skirting Gibbet Wood in a lane so narrow that its hedgerows scratched and tore at the sides of the jolting van.
"Don't mind my hip bones," Nia said, laughing.
We were squeezed as tightly together in the front seat as worms in an angler's tin. With Rupert driving, Nia and I were almost sitting on one another's lap, each with an arm across the other's shoulders. The Austin backfired fiercely as Rupert, according to some ancient and secret formula known only to him, fiddled alternately with the choke and the throttle.
"These Inglebys now!" he shouted above the incessant string of explosions. "Tell us something about them."
The Inglebys were rather morose individuals who kept mostly to themselves. From time to time I had seen Gordon Ingleby dropping off Grace, his tiny doll-like wife, at the village market where, dressed always in black, she sold eggs and butter with little enthusiasm beneath a striped canopy. I knew, as did everyone else in Bishop's Lacey, that the Inglebys' seclusion had begun with the tragic death of their only child, Robin. Before that, they had been friendly and outgoing people, but ever since had turned inward. Even though 5 years had passed, the village still allowed them their grief.
"They farm," I said.
"Ah," said Rupert, as if I had just rhymed off the entire Ingleby family history from the time of William the Conqueror.
The van bucked and jerked as we climbed ever higher, and Nia and I had to brace our palms against the dashboard to keep from knocking our heads together.
"Grim old place, this," she said, nodding to the dense woods on our left. Even the few flecks of sunlight that did manage to penetrate the dense foliage seemed to be swallowed up in the dim world of the ancient trunks.
"It's called Gibbet Wood," I said. "There used to be a village nearby called Wops Hill, till about the 18th century, I think, but there's nothing left of it now. The gallows was at the old crossroads at the centre of the wood. If you climb up that path, you can still see the timbers. They're quite rotten, though."
"Ugh," Nia said. "No, thank you."
I decided it was best, at least for the time being, not to tell her that it was at the crossroads in Gibbet Wood that Robin Ingleby had been found hanging.
"Good Lord," Rupert said, "what in hell is that?"
He pointed to something dangling from a tree branch, something moving in the morning breeze.
"Mad Meg's been here,"
I said. She picks up empty tins and rubbish along the roads and strings them on bits of cord. She likes shiny things. She's rather like a magpie. A pie plate, a rusty Bovril tin, a bit of silver from a radiator shell, and a bent soup spoon, like some grotesque Gothic fishing lure, twisted slowly this way and that in the sun. Rupert shook his head and turned his attention back to the choke and the throttle. As we reached the peak of Gibbet Hill, the motor emitted a most frightful bang and, with a sucking gurgle, died. The van jerked to a halt as Rupert threw on the handbrake. I could see by the deep lines on his face that he was nearly exhausted. He pounded at the steering wheel with his fists. "Don't say it," Nia said. "We have company." I thought for a moment she was referring to me, but her finger was pointing through the windscreen to the side of the lane where a dark, grimy face peered out at us from the depths of a hedgerow. "It's Mad Meg," I said. "She lives in there somewhere in the wood." As Meg came scuttling alongside the van, I felt Nia shrink back. "Oh, don't worry, she's really quite harmless." Meg, in a tattered outfit of rusty black bombazine, looked like a vulture that had been sucked up by a tornado and spat back out. A red glass cherry bobbed cheerfully from a wire on her black flower-pot hat.
"Aye, harmless," Meg said, conversationally, at the open window. "Be ye therefore wise as serpents and harmless as doves. Hello, Flavia."
"These are my friends, Meg, Rupert and Nia." In view of the fact that we were crammed together, cheek by jowl in the Austin, I thought it would be all right to call Rupert by his Christian name. Meg took her time staring at Nia. She reached out a filthy finger and touched Nia's lipstick. Nia cringed slightly but covered it nicely with a tiny counterfeit sneeze. "It's Tangi," she said brightly. "Theatrical red. Changes colour when you put it on. Here, give it a try." It was a magnificent job of acting, and I had to give her top marks for the way in which she disguised her fear with an open and cheery manner. I had to shift a bit so that she could fish in her pocket for the lipstick. As she held it out, Meg's filthy fingers snapped the golden tube from her hand. Without taking her eyes from Nia's face, Meg painted a broad swath of the stuff across her chapped and dirty lips, pressing them together as if she were drinking from a straw.
"Lovely," Nia said. "Gorgeous."
Again, she reached into her pocket and extracted an enamel powder compact, an exquisite thing of flame orange cloisonné, shaped like a butterfly. She flipped it open to reveal the little round mirror in the lid, and after a quick glance at herself, handed it over to Meg. "Here, have a look." In a flash, Meg had seized the compact and was scrutinizing herself in the glass, turning her head animatedly from side to side. Satisfied with what she saw, she rewarded us with a broad grin that revealed the black gaps left by several missing teeth.
"Lovely," she muttered, "smashing,"
and she shoved the orange butterfly into her pocket.
"Here!"
Rupert made a grab for it, and Meg drew back, startled, as if noticing him for the first time. Her smile vanished as suddenly as it had appeared.
"I know you," she said darkly, her eyes fixed on his goatee. "You're the devil, you are. Aye, that's what's gone and happened. The devil's come back to Gibbet Wood."
And with that, she stepped backwards into the hedgerow and was gone. Rupert climbed awkwardly out of the van and slammed the door.
"Rupert!"
Nia called out. But rather than going into the bushes after Meg, as I thought he would, Rupert walked a short distance up the road, looked round a bit, and then came slowly back, his feet stirring up the dust.
"It's only a gentle slope, and we're no more than a stone's throw from the top," he reported. "If we can push her up as far as that old chestnut, we can coast down the far side. Might even start her up again. Like to steer, Flavia?"
Although I had spent hours sitting in Harriet's old Phantom II in our coach house, it had been always for purposes of reflection or escape. I had never actually been in control of a moving motor car. Although the idea was not unattractive at first, I quickly realized that I had no real desire to find myself hurtling out of control down the east side of Gibbet Hill and coming to grief among the scenery. "No," I said, "perhaps Nia."
"Nia doesn't like to drive," he snapped.
I knew at once that I had put my foot in it, so to speak. By suggesting that Nia steer, I was at the same time suggesting that Rupert get off his backside and push, withered leg and all.
"What I meant," I said, "was that you're probably the only one of us who can get the motor started again."
It was the oldest trick in the book, appealed to his manly vanity, and I was proud to have thought of it.
"Right," he said, clambering back into the driving seat.
Nia scrambled out and I behind her. Any thoughts I might have had about the wisdom of someone in her condition pushing a van uphill on a hot day were instantly put aside. And besides, I could hardly bring up the subject. Like a flash, Nia had darted round behind the van, pressing her back flat against the rear doors and using her powerful legs to push.
"Take off the bloody handbrake, Rupert," she shouted.
I took up a position beside her and, with every last ounce of strength that was in me, dug in my feet and pushed. Wonder of wonders, the stupid thing began to move. Perhaps because the puppet paraphernalia had been unloaded at the parish hall, the greatly lightened van was soon creeping, snail-like but inexorably, up towards the peak of the hill. Once we had it in motion, we turned round and shoved with our hands. The van came to a full stop only once, and that was when Rupert threw in the clutch and turned on the ignition. A tremendous black backfire came shooting out of the tailpipe, and even without looking down, I knew that I would have to explain to Father the destruction of yet another pair of white socks.
"Don't let the clutch in now. Wait until we get to the top," Nia shouted.
"Men," she muttered to me.
"Men and their bleeding exhaust noises."
10 minutes later, we were at the crest of Gibbet Hill. In the distance, Jubilee Field sloped away towards the river, a gently rolling blanket of flax of such electric blue intensity that it might have caused Van Gogh to weep.
"One more good heave," Nia said, "and we're on our way."
We groaned and we grunted, pushing and shoving against the hot metal, and then suddenly, as if it had become weightless, the van began moving on its own. We were on the downside of the hill.
"Quick, jump in," Nia said,
and we ran alongside as the van picked up speed, bucketing and bumping down the rutted road. We jumped onto the running board and Nia threw open the door. A moment later, we had collapsed, hugging one another, into the seat as Rupert manipulated the engine controls. Halfway down, as the motor started at last, the van gave off an alarming backfire before settling down to an unhealthy coughing. At the bottom of the hill, Rupert touched the brakes, and we turned neatly into the lane that leads to Culverhouse Farm. Overheated from its exertions, the Austin stood sputtering and steaming like a leaky tea kettle in the farmyard, which, to all intents and purposes, seemed to be abandoned. In my experience, whenever you arrived at a farm, someone always came out of the barn to greet you, wiping his oily hands on a rag and calling to a woman with a basket of eggs to bake some scones and put the tea on. At the very least, there should have been a barking dog. Although there were no pigs in evidence, a weathered sty at the end of a row of tumbled-down sheds was full of tall nettles. Beyond that was a turreted dovecote. Assorted milk pails, all of them rusty, lay scattered about the yard, and a lone hen picked half-heartedly among the weeds, watching us with its wary yellow eye. Rupert climbed out of the van and slammed the door loudly.
"Hello," he called. "Anyone here?"
There was no reply. He walked past a battered chopping block to the back door of the house and gave it a thunderous knocking with his fist.
"Hello? Anyone at home?"
He cupped his hands, peering in through the grimy window of what must once have been the buttery, then motioned us out of the van.
"Odd,"
he whispered.
There's someone standing in the middle of the room. I can see his outline against the far window.
He gave the door a couple more loud bangs.
Mr. Ingleby, I called out. Mrs. Ingleby, it's me, Flavia Deluce. I've brought the people from the church.
There was a long silence, and then we heard the sound of heavy boots on a wooden floor. The door creaked open upon a dark interior, and a tall blonde man in overalls stood blinking in the light. I had never seen him before in my life.
I'm Flavia Deluce, I said, from Buckshaw.
I waved my hand vaguely in its direction to the southeast.
The vicar asked me to show these people the way to Culverhouse Farm.
The blonde man stepped outside, bending substantially in order to get through the low doorway without banging his head. He was what Feely would have described as indecently gorgeous, a towering Nordic god. As this fair-haired Siegfried turned to close the door carefully behind him, I saw that there was a large, faded red circle painted on the back of his boiler suit.
It meant he was a prisoner of war.
My mind flew instantly back to the wooden block and the missing axe. Had he chopped up the Inglebys and stacked their limbs like firewood behind the kitchen stove?
What a preposterous thought! The war had been over for 5 years, and I had seen the Inglebys, at least Grace, as recently as last week. Besides, I already knew that German prisoners of war were not particularly dangerous. The first ones I had seen were on my first ever visit to a cinema, the Palace in Hindley. As the blue-jacketed captives were marched by their armed guards into the theatre and seated, Daffy had nudged me and pointed.
"The enemy," she had whispered.
As the lights went down and the film began, Feely had leaned over and said,
"Just think, you'll be sitting with them in the dark for 2 hours. Alone, if Daffy and I go for sweets."
The film was In Which We Serve, and I couldn't help noticing that when HMS Torin was sunk in the Mediterranean by the Luftwaffe's dive bombers, although the prisoners did not applaud the deed openly, there were nevertheless smiles among them.
"Captured Germans are not to be treated inhumanely," Father had told us when we got home, quoting something he had heard on the wireless, "but are to be shown very clearly that we regard them, officers and men, as outcasts from the society of decent men."
Although I respected Father's word, at least in principle, it was clear that the man who had greeted us at Culverhouse Farm was no outcast, not by any stretch of the imagination. 5 years after the coming of peace, he could only be wearing his bull's-eyed boiler suit out of pride. "May I present myself? I am Dieter Schranz," he said, with a broad smile, shaking hands with each of us in turn, beginning with Nia. From those 4 words alone, I could tell that he spoke nearly perfect English. He even pronounced his own name the way any Englishman would have done, with hard R's and A's and no unpleasant snarling of his surname. "The vicar said that you should come."
"Bloody van broke down," Rupert said, jerking his head towards the Austin with, I thought, a certain measure of aggressiveness, as if he...
Dieter grinned.
"Don't worry. I'll help you run it down the lane to Jubilee Field. That's where you're billeted, you know, old chap."
Old chap? Dieter had obviously been in England for quite some time.
"Is Mrs. Ingleby at home?" I asked.
I thought that it was probably best if Nia was given a tour of the amenities, as it were, before she had to ask. The shadow of a cloud passed over Dieter's face.
"Gordon's gone off up the woods somewhere," he said, gesturing to Gibbet Hill.
"He likes to work alone most of the time. He'll be down presently to help Sally in the meadow. We shall see them when we take your bus down to the river."
Sally was Sally Straw, a member of the Women's Land Army, or Land Girl, as they were called, who had been working at Culverhouse Farm since sometime during the war.
"All right," I said.
"Hello, here's Tick and Tock."
Mrs. Ingleby's 2 tortoiseshell cats came ambling out of a shed, yawning and stretching in the sun. She often took them with her for company to the market, as she did several of her farm creatures, including, now and then, her pet goose, Matilda. Tick, she had informed me once when I inquired about their names, because she has ticks, and Tock, because she chatters like a magpie. Tock was walking directly towards me, already well launched into a meowling conversation. Tick, meanwhile, ambled off towards the dovecote, which rose up darkly from behind the warren of shabby, overgrown sheds.
"You go on ahead," I said. "I'll come down to the field in a few minutes."
I swept Tock up into my arms.
"Who's a pretty pussy, then?"
I cooed, watching from the corner of my eye to see if anyone was taken in. I knew that the cat was not. She had begun to squirm immediately. But Rupert and Nia were already piling into the van, which still stood shuddering away to itself in the yard. Dieter gave a shove and climbed onto the running board, and a moment later, with a wave, they were bumping out of the yard and into the lane that led down the slope to Jubilee Field and the river. A gentle backfire in the middle distance confirmed their departure. The moment they were out of sight, I put Tock down in the dusty yard.
"Where's Tick?" I said. "Go find her."
Tock resumed her long feline monologue and stalked off to the dovecote. Needless to say, I followed. Chapter 7. The dovecote was a work of art. There's no other way of putting it, and I shouldn't have been in the least surprised to hear that the National Trust had its eye on it. It was from this remarkable specimen of architecture that Culverhouse Farm had taken its name, Culver House being the old word for a dovecote. This one was a tall round tower of ancient bricks, each one the shade of a faded rose, but no two of them alike. Built in the time of Queen Anne, it had once been used to breed and raise doves for the farm's dinner table. In those days, the legs of the little dovelets were snapped to keep them fattening in the nest. This fact gleaned from the kitchen chatter of Mrs. Mullet. But times had changed. Gordon Ingleby was an avid pigeon fancier, and the birds that had lived in the tower in this century were more likely to be coddled by hand than in boiling water. At the weekends, he had sent them off by rail to some far-flung flyspeck on the map of England, where they would be released to come flapping immediately back to Culverhouse Farm. Here, they would be welcomed by the slapping off of elaborate mechanical time clocks, much petting and bragging, and a great gorging on grain by the birds. At least, such had been the case until little Robin Ingleby had been found hanging by the neck from the rotted gallows in Gibbet Wood. Since that day, other than a few wild specimens, there had been no more doves at Culverhouse Farm. Poor Robin, when he died, had been the same age as I was then, and I found it hard to believe that someone so young could actually be dead. Still, it was a fact. When one lives in a village, the more things are hushed up, the more one hears, and I remembered the undercurrent of gossip that had swept through Bishop's Lacey at the time, lapping away like the tide at the timbers beneath a pier.
"They say young Robin Ingleby's gone and killed himself. Robin Ingleby's been done in by his parents. The little lad's been slaughtered by Satanists, mark my words."
Most of these theories had been leaked to me by Mrs. Mullet, and I thought of them now as I approached the tower, gazing up in wonder at its myriad of openings. As that monk called the Lector had done in the monasteries of the Middle Ages, Daffy often read aloud to us as we ate our meals. We had recently been treated to Henry Savage Lander's description, in Across Coveted Lands, of the Towers of Silence in Persia, on top of which the Parsis placed corpses in a sitting position, with a stick under the chin to keep them upright. When the crows arrived to squabble over the body, it was considered a ticket to heaven if the right eyeball was the first one consumed. The left was not quite so auspicious. I could not help thinking of this now, and of the author's account of the curious circular pigeon towers of Persia, each with a deep central pit for the collection of guano, whose production was the sole reason for keeping the birds.
Could there be, I wondered, some strange connection between towers, birds, death, and corruption? As I paused there for a moment, trying to think what it might be,
A peculiar sound came drifting from the tower. At first I thought it might be the muttering and cooing away to themselves of doves, high above my head in the coat. Or was it the wind?
It seemed too sustained to be either of these, rising and falling like the sound of a ghostly air raid siren, almost at the threshold of hearing. The sagging wooden door stood ajar, and I found that I could slip through easily into the hollow center of the tower. Tok brushed past my ankles, then vanished into the shadows in search of mice. The sharp reek of the place slapped me in the face, the unmistakable chemical smell of dove's guano, which the great Humphrey Davy had found to yield, by distillation, carbonate of